is Thursday, December 17th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, France's president tests positive for COVID-19.
An aide to the president has told reporters that the 42-year-old Macron is feeling well and has been video conferencing with some of his ministers.
Also ahead, what will a Joe Biden presidency mean for U.S.-Russia relations?
Biden administration is likely to reassert human rights as a key plan foreign policy toward Russia.
Plus, a look at a sharp rise in arrests of journalists worldwide. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in France, where French President Emmanuel Macron has tested positive for COVID-19. He joins other world leaders, including U.S. President Donald Trump, Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro, and the U.K.'s Boris Johnson, who all also contracted the virus. Journalist Catherine Fields in Paris has the story.
In a statement, the French president's office said that Emmanuel Macron was tested after the onset of the first symptoms and will self-isolate for 7 days in line with protocols. However, he will continue to work and carry out his activities remotely. Since the announcement was made, an aide to the president has told reporters that the 42-year-old Macron is feeling well and has been video conferencing with some of his ministers. However, a visit to Beirut, scheduled for next week, has been cancelled, and there is now a question mark over the traditional French president's Christmas Eve dinner with French troops stationed abroad. This COVID-19 diagnosis comes after a busy 3 days for the president, which included in-person meetings with government officials and European Union representatives, and an in-person event at the Organization for Economic Cooperation, which was also attended by the Spanish Prime Minister and the head of the European Commission. Among those who've been designated as close contacts and have also gone into self-isolation are the Spanish and Portuguese Prime Ministers, the French Prime Minister, and the Speaker of the French National Assembly. A French government spokesman has said social distancing protocols were respected and sanitary measures were observed at all of these events, but he told reporters that the president's positive COVID diagnosis shows just how ferocious this virus has become. Since the start of the COVID pandemic, more than 59,000 people have died in France of the virus, and earlier this week, lockdown restrictions were eased and replaced with an 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfew across France. Catherine Field for VOA News, Paris.
In the U.S., President-elect Joe Biden will get the COVID-19 vaccine soon, as will Vice President Mike Pence. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani reports.
When asked yesterday if he'd received the shot, Biden said his team was working on it and that frontline health workers and the elderly are still the top priority.
I don't want to get ahead of the line, but I want to make sure that we demonstrate to the American people that it is safe to take.
Two transition officials later said Biden will publicly get the vaccine as early as next week. Before that, the vice president and his wife will receive it Friday at the White House. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern announced today that the country will begin to offer free COVID-19 vaccines to its entire population by the middle of next year. Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters reports.
New Zealand announced on Thursday it secured enough COVID-19 vaccines for its entire population of 5 million and will begin a free mass immunization program from the middle of next year. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said two new deals have been signed with AstraZeneca and Novavax. She said the government plans to vaccinate border staff and health workers from April, widening it out to the general population in the second half of the year. Some of the vaccines will also be sent to countries in the Pacific.
Never before has the entire globe sought to vaccinate the entire population at the same time. Ours will be a sustained rollout over months, not weeks, but our pre-purchase agreements means New Zealand is well positioned to get on with it as soon as it is proven safe to do so.
It marks the end of a good year for Ardern, who's been widely praised for her handling of the pandemic. New Zealand's economy has also managed to rebound from the hard lockdown of March to May, growing by a record 14% in the third quarter, according to official figures released on Thursday.
That's Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters. The World Health Organization's vaccine chief, Dr. Catherine O'Brien, said that every country should have access to COVID-19 vaccines as early as feasible, but warns that the call for global solidarity has mostly been lost as richer countries buy out vaccine stocks. Now there are fears that people in countries that are shut out of the COVID vaccine rollouts may turn to scientifically unproven alternatives as they face a second wave of the pandemic. For more on this, my VOA colleague Chinedu Ofor spoke with Kate Elder, who is a senior vaccines policy advisor for Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, in New York, about the concerns of her group.
Wealthy countries like the European Union bloc, the UK, the United States of America, Canada, they certainly have invested a tremendous sum. I don't want to disregard the tens of billions of dollars that governments, including my own, the government of the United States, I think about $12 billion into Operation Warp Speed and into the development of financing research and development, financing what we call at-risk manufacturing scale-up. So basically paying pharmaceutical companies to start developing manufacturing capacity before they even have approved vaccines, and then also engaging in contracts to secure, you know, tens of millions of doses in advance. They have paid from the public's purse. It is our taxpayer dollars that have paid for this. There are some vaccines like Moderna's vaccine where almost 100% of the research and development has been financed by the public purse. And certainly governments need to get something in return. But what they're getting in return right now is handsome returns in terms of securing doses for their domestic populations, but they're not doing it in a globally minded way. And I think the most important thing is every American citizen, for example, every European citizen should understand that they're truly not safe until everybody in the world is safe. These vaccines are going to be a tremendous help to our public health package of combating COVID-19, for sure. But they're not the panacea. They need to be used in tandem with other public health measures. And everybody around the world who is most vulnerable needs to be protected if anybody is going to be protected. A person sitting here in Brooklyn, where I'm sitting, is vulnerable to coronavirus if somebody in a country in South Sudan, in Niger, is vulnerable, because we are just an interconnected world. You can't isolate yourself. So I hope that citizens of these countries, which are going to benefit from this tremendous public investment, I hope they have that awareness.
Are there fears that some people in these poorer countries, if they are able to get access to COVID vaccines, might turn to some unscientifically unproven cure, making the matter worse?
We're globally connected. People read the news. People in countries which right now are truly at the back of the line and likely won't see COVID-19 vaccines for months, if not possibly years, they're reading what's happening in the news. They're reading that people in the United States are getting these vaccines right now. People in the UK are getting these vaccines. And they're likely frustrated because it's not that they're immune, no pun intended, from coronavirus there. I don't know what people will resort to if they feel like they, you know, don't get access to the leading medical tools. I hope that people use their wherewithal to be able to assess what's truly, you know, a medical intervention and what is an unfounded remedy. I wouldn't want to dismiss people and say that they'll sort of take these unscientifically substantiated measures. I think that's what those people want is they want access to the medical tools that everybody around the world should have. They want access to the medical tools that shouldn't just be a luxury of people sitting in wealthy countries. And I hope that with global collaboration, I hope that with global solidarity, that organizations here in the United States that are fighting for access for people in other countries, organizations in the UK and EU that are fighting for access for people in poorer countries, will work collaboratively with people in those countries so that we can, you know, achieve this together.
That's Kate Elder, Senior Vaccines Policy Advisor for Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, in New York, speaking to my VOA colleague Chinedu Ofor. This is VOA. The Pacific Islands nation of Fiji ordered its entire population to take shelter today in the path of what is expected to be the worst storm in its recorded history. Cyclone Yasa, a Category 5 storm, is expected to bring winds of up to 250 kilometers per hour and torrential rain. The storm made landfall over Bua province on the northern island of Vanua-Levu at about 6 p.m. local time today. Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama said more than 95% of the population live in the storm's direct path. He warned of flash flooding and waves up to 10 meters high. A Chinese lunar capsule returns to Earth today with the first fresh rock samples that humans have brought from the moon in more than 40 years. The China National Space Administration reported the capsule of the Chang'e 5 probe landed just before 2 a.m. local time in the Inner Mongolia region. The capsule had earlier separated from its orbiter module and performed a bounce off Earth's atmosphere to reduce its speed before passing through the atmosphere and floating to the ground on parachutes. And it has emerged that the top U.S. military officer held an unannounced meeting with Taliban peace negotiators earlier this week to push for a reduction in violence in Afghanistan. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Mark Milley held about 2 hours of talks at a hotel in the Qatari capital Doha Tuesday. He then flew Wednesday to Kabul and met with Afghan President Ashraf Ghani. Milley told reporters traveling with him that he emphasized to both sides the need to reduce violence to reach a nationwide ceasefire. For security reasons, the journalists traveling with Milley agreed not to report on the talks until he had left the region.
To keep track of and measure time. The U.S. National Institute for Standards and Technology says its atomic clock in Boulder, Colorado is so accurate that it only varies by 0.03 nanoseconds per day, or about 1 second in 100 million years. Physicists at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology say they have designed a new type of atomic clock that's not only more accurate, but could also help detect physics phenomena such as dark matter and gravitational waves. Unlike the atomic clocks of today, which measure the oscillations of random atoms, the new MIT clock gauges atoms that have become quantumly entangled. The website sciencedaily.com defines that as atoms that have lost their individuality and synced up with each other. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. As preparations for the inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden intensify, one of the most anticipated foreign policy plans for his administration regards U.S.-Russia relations. In a recent congratulatory message to Biden, President Vladimir Putin said that despite differences, he hoped both nations can, quote, contribute to solving many problems and challenges that the world is currently facing, end quote. But analysts are not holding out much hope for improved ties. For more, my VOA colleague Chinadu Ofor spoke with Rafael Sakov from VOA's Russia service here in Washington.
You know, there already was a recent attempt in U.S.-Russia relationship from the Obama administration starting in 2009 with then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton offering a red reset button to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Washington. But we all know that it failed and disappointed both Democrats and Republicans in the U.S. when Russia annexed Crimea from Ukraine and started war in eastern Ukraine in 2014. Also, Russia intervened in the Syrian war on the side of Bashar Assad in 2015. As a final accord, there was the Russian interference into the U.S. election in 2016. So there are doubts among experts that President-elect Biden would choose once again an attempt to make things better with Russia without challenging Kremlin and Vladimir Putin on many issues. And the main question is now, should there be a reset with the leadership of the country? So there are many issues to be solved before the real process of making U.S.-Russia relations better could potentially begin. And Biden administration is likely to reassert human rights as a key plan foreign policy toward Russia.
Despite these differences, do you see any areas of cooperation?
Of course, counterterrorism is one of them. We remember when in 2017, Russia's president called President Trump to thank him for information provided by the CIA that allegedly helped to prevent a terrorist attack in Russia's second largest city, St. Petersburg. And Donald Trump's long-held position has been that Washington should forge closer ties with Russia to fight international terrorism. However, we have heard from many U.S. experts that Russia is not a viable counterterrorism partner for the United States. On a practical level, there are many difficulties, such as sharing intelligence, while there is actual mistrust in the U.S.-Russia ties, and you can go nowhere from this point. And also, Moscow's and Washington's goals and approaches are in many cases different. And sometimes Russia is fighting against different groups and for different reasons, and with the main one being, as we all know, to fracture NATO. So there are many obstacles to this kind of cooperation with Russia, while, of course, upon taking office on January 20, Joe Biden faces an immediate decision on whether to extend the New START arms treaty with Russia, which otherwise expires 16 days later, freeing Moscow to deploy unlimited numbers of strategic nuclear warheads. And many experts fear New START's demise could fuel a nuclear arms race. So in this point of view, of course, there will be talks, I think, immediately after the inauguration.
That's Rafael Sakov from VOA's Russia service here in Washington, speaking to my colleague Chinedu Afor. New reports released this week by two press freedom watchdogs detail a sharp rise in arrests and detainings of journalists around the world, including in the United States. For more on the trend, I reached out to VOA's press freedom desk editor, Jessica Jarrett. Jessica, thank you for joining us. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thank you. Can you first give us an overview of one of these new reports that just came out by the Committee to Protect Journalists? What are the key findings of their report?
So the Committee to Protect Journalists just released its annual census of jailed journalists. The key findings in this report is that it's just the worst year on record. They found 274 journalists jailed in retaliation for their work globally, in part because of the COVID pandemic, but it's also just this increasing authoritarian reaction to critical and independent reporting.
And who are some of the countries that are topping the list? Who are the worst jailers of journalists in the world?
The top three offenders are ones that we see regularly on these lists. You have China, Turkey, Egypt. There are also a couple of new entries on there. Belarus, where there have been crackdowns since the contested re-election of President Alexander Lukashenko. There are 10 journalists still in prison there, still in December. These are people who were arrested between August and November during these big protests. In Ethiopia, which had had this more promising signs of reform for press freedom since the conflict started in Tigray in November, six of the seven journalists who CPJ count on their list are arrested because of their coverage there.
Now, one of the journalists on the list, Ruhollah Sam, an Iranian journalist, he was in jail, but he's now actually dead. He was executed over the weekend. Can you go into what happened with him?
Ruhollah Sam, the really sad fact about this case is that he had fled into exile. He knew he was facing charges for inciting violence during anti-government protests in 2017, and he'd found a new life for himself in France. He traveled to Iraq last year, and Iranian authorities managed to find a way to have him extradited to Iran. He was convicted and hanged on Saturday. The U.S. has responded strongly to that. Secretary of State Pompeo has condemned it as a barbaric execution. But his case exemplifies something that we do see a lot. Journalists flee into exile in Iran and other countries, but the retaliation and the fear and risk that they still face follows them. It's something that VOA's Press Freedom and Extremism Watch desks looked into a couple of months ago. We profiled 14 journalists, two of them in Iran, but others in Bangladesh, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, who spoke about what it's like to go into exile, move thousands of miles away, but still know that intelligence agents are still going to knock on your parents' door and demand to know why their son or daughter is still reporting critically and writing anti-government sentiment, just because these journalists, from the safety or the relative safety of being abroad, are trying to still shine a light on some of the corruption and wrongdoing in their home countries.
Now I want to turn to the U.S. There was a second report released this week by the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, and it looked at arrests and detainings of journalists here in the U.S. What did it find?
Yep. So the Press Freedom Tracker, it just looks at cases in the U.S. And what it found in 2020 is just this unprecedented number of journalists being briefly detained or arrested in the U.S. Between the start of the protests following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis in May, they've counted 120 cases of journalists being arrested now. They're still verifying new cases, so this figure's just going up and up each day. And, you know, it's difficult covering protests. It's, you're in the heat of the moment. It can be hard for police to determine who is there legitimately as a journalist who has the rights to document what's happening and who's a protester or someone who might be trying to create unrest. But what we've been seeing this year is wholesale just journalists being caught up, detained, held. A lot of the times, these journalists' footage is shown on social media of the moment that they're arrested, and you can see them identifying themselves as press, calling out, "I'm press, I'm press," and they're still detained, or in some cases, they have pepper spray sprayed directly in their faces. The American Civil Liberties Union, the nonprofit, is filing a couple of lawsuits, one in Portland, Oregon, where we saw a lot of extreme clashes with police and protesters, and in Minneapolis, just saying that there was an excessive use of police force in response to press who were legitimately there acting as the eyes and ears for the people wanting to know what these protests are about.
Over 100 arrests or detainings of journalists in the U.S. this year. Have these journalists mostly been released? And also, have any of these arrests actually led to any charges? And have any charges actually held up in court?
Most times these journalists are just detained very briefly and released without charge. There have been no convictions, but there's 16 journalists who are still facing criminal charges because of their work covering these protests.
That's VOA Press Freedom Desk editor Jessica Jarrett. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us.
Right. Thanks, Jason.
UN humanitarian agencies are calling for an end to deadly sea journeys that are taken by Venezuelans fleeing persecution and hardship in their country. For VOA, Lisa Schlein in Geneva filed this report.
UN humanitarian agencies are calling for a stop to the deadly sea journeys on smugglers' boats that are endangering the lives of Venezuelan refugees and migrants fleeing persecution and hardship there. This appeal follows the latest loss of life in the waters near the Venezuelan coastal town of Guiria several days ago. Up to 25 refugees and migrants, among them four children, whose boat had capsized offshore, were found floating in the sea. The shipwrecked vessel reportedly set sail for Trinidad and Tobago on December 6th. In the wake of this tragedy, UN agencies are calling for urgent efforts to stop smugglers and human traffickers sending refugees and migrants on dangerous sea journeys. The UN Human Rights Office is calling on authorities in Venezuela and Trinidad and Tobago to launch an investigation into the incident. Mata Hurtado, spokeswoman for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, says both governments have agreed to do so.
Both governments have to conduct investigations, probably transparent, and share their outcomes, and to cooperate between them, not only to solve, to understand what happened in this case, and to prosecute whoever needs to be prosecuted if they found the people responsible for it, but to avoid this tragedy happens again.
The UN Refugee Agency and International Organization for Migration report more Venezuelans have been leaving their country in recent weeks as COVID-19 lockdown measures in the region have eased. However, they note land and maritime borders remain closed, forcing them to escape using informal, dangerous routes. They say smugglers and human traffickers who exploit and abuse desperate people for profit are taking advantage of this situation. UN agencies say regular pathways must be available so refugees and migrants don't have to risk their lives. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That's Lisa Schlein in Geneva, and that's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, my colleague, Chinadu O4, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Washington journalists as they deliberate the latest top stories of the week. Think- including the U.S., leads the world in total cases and deaths of the coronavirus, according to Johns Hopkins University. Don't miss Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday.